Tonight on Arena, The Dead, a new operatic production from Performance Corporation, and Colin Hansard on his new collection of poetry, Age of the Microwave Dinner. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena on Saturday and Sunday of this week. 50 lucky people at a time will sit down in the Gaiety Theatre's elegant auditorium to enjoy a revival of Performance Corporation's production of The Dead, an opera based on the beloved short story by James Joyce. The show is performed by four actors and singers, or singers and actors, depending on what way you want to look at it, three of whom are in multiple roles. The music was composed by Ellen Cranitch, with the libretto by playwright Tom Swift. And delighted to be joined by Tom Swift with me in studio this evening, and the production director, Joe Mangan. You couldn't find, Tom, if you tried, a better setting for James Joyce's The Dead in terms of theatre than the Gaiety, really. It's of the era, it's of the period, and it's even in kind of that music hall style that I think you're going for in this production.
Exactly, yeah. We were just talking about it before coming on air, and it's just so full of resonance and so full of poignancy in a way. Like, obviously Joyce would have gone there as an audience member, and there's even a reference to the Gaiety panto in the story The Dead. So at one point, Freddie Mallins, the drunk of the piece, starts to sort of wax lyrical about a singer that he's seen, the best he's ever seen in his life. So yeah, there's loads of resonance, and you're in the green room and you see all the greats up on the wall, you know. So it's about those people who've gone before us, which is, you know, a big part of what The Dead is about, you know, the influence that those who've gone before us have on people's lives. So it's great.
And this is a production. This is a production that you've had on the go for a while, Joe. But this is a situation that who knew we were going to be in this situation for the last 18 months to 2 years, where you're finally getting back into a theatre space with an audience of 50 in the Gaiety. It's not going to be packed out, but it's an audience, and I guess that's the important thing.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. I'm very privileged to be there, as Tom said. It's such a stunning space, and I've snaffled dressing room one for myself, so I've got Maureen Potter looking down on me wisely. It's amazing, really. Just, I think, you know, what's possible even with an audience of 50. I've seen some work, or been involved in some work in the past few months that's been able to happen, and the emotional connection between an audience that hasn't seen anything in so long and what's coming off the stage. To be honest with you, we could be putting on anything. Do you know, we're not putting on anything. We're putting on something beautiful and something extraordinary and something that we know works and that has kind of, you know, been tried and tested. And I'm so thrilled to be in there, and it's just such a privilege. Breda Cash is our producer, and, you know, she worked to get funds from the department to make this happen. It's not the kind of thing that would happen normally with 50 in the audience. You know, it's hard enough to be putting on theatre in normal circumstances, but in these circumstances it's really quite unique and special.
And was there something specific about The Dead that spoke to, you know, the moment that we're in right now? I mean, I'm sure you had other productions, and The Dead had done very well, so it was an obvious one in some ways to bring back, and given the Gaiety and what we've just said. But is there something within the piece itself, do you think, that really talks to where we are now?
Yeah, it's multi-layered. I mean, I think we've all been touched by what has happened in the past while, either personally or adjacently. We're aware of what's going on around the world. The Dead, it's got the worst name in the world for a light piece of musical theatre, you know, which is effectively what it is. It's a really enjoyable evening. It's under an hour, or matinee in a couple of the cases that we're doing. And, you know, I suppose the layers of complexity within the piece are many, and they speak to the times that we're in. But really, it's about that kind of levity, that entertainment, connection with audience, wanting to get back out there and wanting to really, you know, we're resuscitating The Dead. We're reviving, like, we've all the puns. We're doing it all. They're all there.
But I suppose it is that idea. It's a Christmas party as much as anything else, Tom. That's what we're talking about, you know, a bundle of people from a community coming together to celebrate this Christmas party, which even was something we couldn't have done during the period of the pandemic, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah, exactly. And it's full, as Joe said, you know, it's full of great, you know, great comedy, great set pieces. The awkwardness of a, you know, having to make a speech, which is the sort of one of the center points of the piece, that Gabriel Conroy has to make this big speech that, you know, honors his aunts who are hosting the party. And you have Freddie Mallins, the drunk, you have dancing, you have embarrassment. And then through it all, you have a sort of a gradual unraveling of awareness about, you know, what it means to be alive and what it means to be, thinking about people who've passed on before. So it's like Joe said, it's all life is there, life and death, and they're all intermingled.
But did you, when you were adapting this and Ellen Cranitch was writing the music and you were involved in taking some of the words of Joyce's stories, I guess, Joyce's story rather,
terrifying.
I guess, and doing some things with them. Were you looking to highlight that kind of music hall side of things in the original, when the idea was first being mooted?
Yeah, very much. And sort of have a variety of musical styles, which is what Ellen has really done so effectively. Because, yeah, it's peppered with references to music hall, to old opera, to high and low opera. And we really wanted to reflect that. And also, naturally, to you know, traditional music as well. There's a piece at the end, the Ballad of Michael Fury, which is the sort of Greta's key moment. So it being about a boy from the West, it has a more kind of traditional tone. So I think Ellen's very cleverly, chosen the musical styles to fit each particular moment.
So in that Greta ballad that comes towards the end, does she reflect on the Lass of Ockham, which is, you know, Greta
exactly.
sings about the Lass of Ockham being sung by Michael Fury. That's
yeah.
the song that the man, the boy, the young boy that she's remembering.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it really reflects that. And I think, you know, the piece is, you know, the choice to actually make it into a piece of music theatre or opera really, you know, comes from the story as well, in the sense that it's very reflective in parts. It's very up and open and celebratory at times, but then it's also very internalised. And how do you do that? And I think opera is a perfect way, because it's the form where you can actually, okay, stop the show. I'm going to sing out and tell you all my feelings. It doesn't make sense, but it's opera.
You also get to do things. I mean, obviously, in the case of Joyce, in the more experimental work, we think of the way he played around with language and the way that he played around with words in parts of Ulysses and in parts of Finnegan's Wake. And it really struck me in a section that this, as we said, was done before. And then there was a radio drama production of it done. And we have a little clip from that just to give a sense of the sort of the style, part of the style of it. And it struck me in this section that we're about to hear, it takes the word galoshes, which I mentioned earlier on. And literally, with you, Tom, and Ellen Cranitch's music, the word galoshes is flung around the cast in a Joycean fashion. Let's have a listen.
Galoshes when it's raining, galoshes over boots. Galoshes, galoshes, galosh, galosh, galosh.
Red coated, red full.
Oshes, galoshes, galosh, galosh, galosh.
Red coated, red full.
Oshes, galoshes, galosh, galosh, galosh.
Red coated, red full.
Oshes, galoshes, 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 galoshes. When it's raining, galoshes over boots. The next thing he will buy me is a diving suit.
So a little section there from The Dead, an opera, the Performance Corporation production that is coming into the Gaiety Theatre later this week, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, in a couple of days' time.
And that, as I said, the RTE drama production of the original stage production developed there. But that's what struck me, Tom. Is that the sort of conversations that yourself and Ellen Cranitch, the composer for this, had around this idea of taking the various words and literally playing with them musically?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, they do say about Joyce that he needs to be read out loud, and, and the choice of a word like galoshes, I mean, that it's beautiful. It's a beautiful word to say, and an unusual word as well.
And it kind of has an inherent comedy in it somehow or other, exactly. The word galoshes.
Yeah, exactly. So it really, it just shows you how clever he was. Not that we need to be told that again, but that he would, it's a sort of a slightly embarrassing moment for Gabriel around a slightly ridiculous piece of clothing. And, you know, then there's the later we've tried to capture in a similar manner in the dinner scene. There's a long list of, you know, luscious foods and drink and beverages that he lists in the piece. And we've tried to play with, riff with those and make a sort of a new kind of rhythm and staccato kind of feeling.
And I guess the piece opens with the word snow, which is hugely, even just that word spoken is hugely evocative. And you do the same thing there where we hear the word snow and then various little bits of text again. Are all the words Joyce's or how did you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, you try to be very respectful, and there's a point where you cut loose, but I would say 99% of the words are in the original text, and the changes that have come have been sort of cutting down and molding into, you know, song form and meter. But yeah, and we've also we found in when we did it originally as a sort of work in progress that we would read parts of the text in between to sort of keep the narrative ticking along from the original story, and we've kept that element of
it. So that narrator element stays in, so that is literally just a read text from the text of the story itself.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, why not? I mean, it reads so beautifully, and it just kind of, it just adds to the atmosphere of the piece, I think.
How important do you think it is, Joe? As I said, this is the first time now that you will have been back. Is it in a performed corporation at any rate? I know you've been involved in other productions when we thought we were coming out of lockdowns and things were getting better, and then they got worse again. Is this the first time for Performance Corporation to actually be back in the live performance situation?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's beautiful, remarkable. Walking into rehearsals the first day was like. Wasn't like a normal rehearsal, you know, it had a real special feeling to it. Everybody wanted to be there. Nobody was dragged out of bed that morning kicking and screaming. Everyone came in with bright, open half faces anyway, from what we could see above the masks. And the process has been we've been really careful with everybody, just obviously because of what's going on in the world, and kind of, you know, you normally work with your team, with your core cast, to build up trust and to build up empathy, and, you know, to create a piece together. And there's this extra layer that we've had to look at and deal with around COVID. So antigen testing every day, making sure our whole cast are safe, has been really important, and building up that, you know, team around, weirdly, health and safety, which is always something that, you know, you kind of leave to the last minute. But
And I'm sure a certain amount of nervousness. I mean, the people wouldn't, the performers, singers and actors would not be normal if they weren't nervous.
Absolutely.
I mean, we all keep our masks on. I know even in studio, obviously, we take them off to speak. Now then the masks go back on afterwards. But the first time you're doing it's quite nervy. There's anxiety around it.
There is. And also, it was remarkable. Thursday was the first day I saw the performers without masks. We had a run in our rehearsal rooms.
Who are these people you
asked? Well, kind of, yeah. Like, they were, you know, they were great from the eyes up, but I didn't know what was going on underneath. And it was brilliant. It was just this beautiful revelation of all of this extraordinary expression. You know, we were blessed with having it all turning out all right when they did take off the masks. But, you know, it's... it's a joy to see. It's a joy to see faces anyway. It's a joy looking across the table at you. You know, Sean, it's like we don't see people anymore. So
did you have to rethink some of the blocking? Because I'm thinking particularly of the fact that singing was one of the things that was spoken about so much around COVID. And, you know, the fact that obviously the projection for singing, there's a lot of vapor in the air as a result of that. Did you have to re-block? Did you have to move people a little bit further away from each other? That type of thing?
A little bit. But because we have a really, you know, strict rate regime around testing as part of the process this time around. We're at a point where we're comfortable, you know, that we know everyone who's coming into the building every day is safe and is negative. And so there are some moments when people are close together. But to be honest with you, not any closer than you would see in, you know, establishments up and down the country probably at this stage with people you don't know.
Yeah, and I suppose the other side of it is because we have, I mentioned that we have effectively, the character of Gabriel remains, is the one person throughout.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and the others are multi-rolling between being Aunt Kate, the elderly aunt, and Lily, the maid. Everyone is swapping around all the time.
But I'm guessing that involves a certain amount of physicality, which again, in the normal course of events, you wouldn't even have to think about. But that must have been something you had to be careful around initially, at any rate.
Definitely, yeah, I think there was definitely, as Joe was saying, the initial moments of rehearsal, there was a nervousness about that, and I think people are not used to. You know, we've grown unaccustomed to touching and to shaking hands and to hugging. So, you know, people bring that into the rehearsal room. We all do. But the cast is fantastic. It's been
and musically, how is the music provided within all of that? Because we heard a kind of a chamber feel to the clip that I played. Is it the string quartet or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. We have a string quartet on stage, so they sit around the dinner table for the most part, tootling away, and they're part of the cast. They inhale the fumes of the dinner as it comes out, and they can't eat and play the fiddle at the same time, though. So they stick to one task at a time. But they're brilliant.
Fiddles down for the eating bits.
No. Fiddles up and watch the cast eat.
Oh, the poor musicians. Well, listen, best of luck with it all.
Thanks a million.
I hope that the production goes to plan, and that I'm sure the 50 people, the sets of 50 people that get in there will enjoy it enormously. Still a few tickets available for some of the performances.
Yeah, there's a couple of tickets, I think, because, you know, they were originally allocated in sixes, so they've been broken up. And then it is going to be in Kilkenny Arts Festival screened there the week after.
Yeah, you'll be doing a filmed version of it.
Exactly.
You can film it in the Gaiety. And
that's
the one that they'll see down in Kilkenny. Okay, so a small number of tickets, as Joe Mangan telling us there, available for the Dead and Opera matinees and evening shows this Saturday and Sunday. That's August 7th and 8th at the Gaiety Theatre. You can book on ticketmaster.ie, and the filmed version of the show will be shown at the Watergate Theatre as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival on August the 15th. And the show will be available to view on demand from August the 16th then, once again at the Gaiety Theatre. GaietyTheatre.ie, KilkennyArts.ie. We'll give you all of the details. This Sunday, Colin Hansard launches his debut poetry collection, Age of the Microwave Dinner. This will take place at the Eastside Arts Festival in Belfast. The event is free, online, and a mix of poetry and music. Colin will play with his band, Dirty Words, as well as reading some of his new poems. The book is divided into five parts, each named after an instruction in the process of microwaving a ready meal, each with a particular theme, beginning with love and heartache, and ending up with death, God, and the meaning of life. I'm delighted to have Colin Hansard join me now, which sounds a bit like, if you like, the Dead for the 21st century, with the dinner being microwaved rather than being cooked in the Markham sisters' household. But maybe you'd start off, if you would, Colin. One of the first places I go to when I get a new collection of poetry is to go to, let's read about this author and find out a bit about him. But you have an interesting type of about the author section in the book. Will you read that for us, first of all?
I would love to. So this poem, it's about the author. That's the title of the poem. And it's written in an A to Z format. So each line starts with the next letter of the alphabet. And I use this poem to let audiences get to know me a little better. Adheres to every only child stereotype. Brings his own confectionery to the cinema. Calls she who couldn't milk a cow. Dresses to impress or recline depending on mood. Emotionally unstable during black and white films. Fascinated by millionaires kicking a ball. Googler of own name. Happy-go-lucky as long as he gets his own way. Irish by birth, British by assimilation. Jack and Coke Casanova with an inferiority complex. Keyboard owner, not player. Looking at the gutter with his head in the clouds. Mummy's boy. Never done a proper day's graft. Once rhymed hum, tongue and lemon in the same verse. Poet of sorts. Quotes other poets better. Refuses to work weeknights, weekends, or for minimum wage. Sexually durable in soft lighting. tolerant of the same sorts, kissing and cuddling. Uses cutlery to eat fast food. Vocalist, but not a singer. Willing to meet like-minded writers for potential plagiarizing. X-rated movie enthusiast, yet to cross his heart and hope to die. Zoologist, animal rights activist, and meat eater.
And that's about the author of the Colin Hansard's opening poem in his collection, Age of the Microwave Dinner. It's always a problem, Colin, with the I in the poet's world. How much of the I in the poet's world is true? How much of the A to Z, in fact, is pretty much Colin Hansard, would you say, or how much of it is slightly exaggerated?
There's probably quite a lot of it in there. I tend to spell my name C-O-L, capital I-N. So I think that that explains that.
Which any particular letter that you think explains more than others?
Probably the first one. Adheres to every only child stereotype.
so
that maybe explains the poetry, the attention seeking, the kind of the loneliness.
Yeah,
introspective.
It also struck me as you read it that when I saw this on the page, I thought that is a poem that needs to be read out, almost that needs to be performed, which is where your background is, certainly in the spoken word area. Oh, have we lost Colin? Yeah, I'll tell you what we do. Colin also sent us on a piece of music, one of the poems, in fact, the Potions and Elixirs, which is the title.
Yeah, and then when I went...
Oh, we're back there. You're back. You're with us. Sorry, Colin. We lost you. We lost you briefly there. I was saying about you know, it struck me that about the author, that poem that you just read for us needs to be read. When you see it on the page, you're kind of wondering what it is. Your background is in performance poetry.
That's right. I grew up having a real set idea of how poetry should be written and how it should be read. And then when I went to my first open mic night in Belfast and I saw people performing their work, that kind of just blew my mind, that these people would learn their poems and perform them and, you know, and speak them and bring in elements of comedy and music and theatre and rap. And that just totally changed my perception of it. So that was kind of that journey I went on for a few years. And I was lucky enough to kind of tour around Ireland and win a few Poetry Slam awards and represent Ulster at the All-Ireland Slam final. And I still enjoy performing on stage, although I haven't been able to do it, obviously, for the past 18 months or so, but it's definitely a great buzz.
And do you see the written poetry and the spoken poetry, are they, or at least were they initially very different disciplines for you?
For me, it's a different process, different approach to them. For example, when I write a spoken word poem, very rarely I would kind of format it on the page. I may break it into smaller sections, almost into paragraphs, just to make it easier for me to read and easier to learn. But I'm not thinking about how it would look on a page, whereas when I'm writing page poetry, to make that distinction, I'm very much thinking about how it looks, how it's formatted, where the line ends, where the breaks are, etc.
Yeah, it struck me in the second poem that I'll ask you to read that perhaps that there's more of the page feel off this, even in the way it sits on the page. Will you give us an introduction into the poem, You're There Now?
I will, and that. It's a good poem to actually mention because this was really the turning point in terms of my writing, because as you mentioned, I came from a performance poetry background, and then I was kind of doubting myself as a page poet. But in January 2017, I was longlisted for the Seamus Heaney Award for New Writing, and it was because of this poem. And because of that nomination, I thought to myself, well, if the Seamus Heaney Award judges think that this poem's good enough on a page, then maybe I might be okay at this. So this is You're There Now. You're there now, sitting on your old sofa, with a knitted rug and matching cushions, surrounded by jazz records and ideas. And on the wall are postcards, and a map of New York City and a calendar. And the coal bucket overflows with news. And the tea is brewed strong, and the teapot sits on a chopping board. And the room smells of vanilla and sometimes cheese. And the book on the meaning of dreams is missing. And beside the door is a bicycle. And the door is open to let the breeze circle the room and carry the off-key notes out into summer. And on Friday, you relax in a warm bath of seaweed carried in a sack from Connemara. And no one cares about any of this, except those who remember what love is.
And that's the poem, You're There Now, from Colin Hansard, from his collection, Age of the Microwave Dinner. It really struck me as you read it there. It even sounds, to my ears at any rate, Colin, very different from the more spoken word aspect of maybe something like About the Author, which has, I know About the Author has a kind of a, novelty isn't quite the right word, but it has that performative aspect to it. this is a much more introspective piece of work. Did you know that heading into it? Had you already decided this is a page poem as you started to write?
I think that was one of the quickest poems that I've ever written. I had come back from a friend's house and they were having a bad time at that period, just through various different kind of relationship issues, and they were kind of doubting their own creativity, and I wanted to write a poem to maybe make them feel a bit better, and the poem kind of flowed out in about 15 or 20 minutes, and I wish they were all that quick. Sometimes, yeah, I do like to bring in humour if it's applicable for the poem, because if I'm maybe writing a poem that has got a strong message behind it, to use humour within it, it kind of makes it easier for people to hear or to understand.
Yeah, because often, we associate, I suppose, spoken word poetry with having quite an amount of activism and certainly political and social thought behind it. Is that there for you in the more spoken word aspect of things?
Definitely, that's something I always consider. Like, I always say that whenever I'm on a stage performing a poem, I'm aware that the audience that are listening to me, they're on a night out. And that doesn't mean that it has to be a laugh a minute, but at least make it interesting, make it inspiring, make it entertaining. And if you can do that, then that's the best way to connect with the audience. Like, I have a poem called Northern Iron, which is how apparently we in the North say Northern Ireland. It goes on for about 4 minutes, and there's various different funny lines.
I'll ask another question first, Colin. Maybe that your line will come back as I'm asking you this, because the fourth section within the book is actually the section that I think you might refer to as being the part of the poem, the part of the collection that has more of a message behind it. I was wondering about the Penguin Trilogy. Does it have much of a message there? Do we have Colin? No, we don't. No, we've.
I'm here. Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, here you are there. Beg your pardon, Colin. I was asking you there about the Penguin Trilogy. Maybe give me a sense of, because this is in the section of the book that would be the more political and social aspect. And social and political didn't jump out at me when I read this first. So maybe give me your take on this particular poem.
It's subtly done through the medium of penguins. So I was in a bar in Belfast one night, and I was introduced to someone who I'd never met. And they asked me, they found out I was a writer, and they asked me what I write about. And that's one of the questions that poets and writers hate being asked. And just off the cuff, I happened to say that I write about penguins. Just the first thing that came to my mind. And as it turns out, this man that I was introduced to was an expert in penguins and on the Arctic. And I thought then afterwards, God, I'm going to have to go and write now a poem about penguins. But I've used penguins in a way that they're a metaphor for people and for other things. So I'm just going to read part two of the Penguin Trilogy.
Right.
If a penguin got the right lawyer, he, she could definitely sue Penguin the biscuit people, Penguin the book people, and Penguin the clothing people for unlawful commercial use of his, her likeness. It would set a precedence in the legal world. Suddenly lawsuits from everywhere. A jaguar suing jaguar, a puma suing puma, an owl suing hooters, and so on, until all companies who wish to use an animal in their branding would be required to have written permission either from a lion, as per its position in the animal kingdom, or directly from a particular species. Apes and other knuckle draggers can at least sign their name and vote in elections, but good luck getting the signature of a red snapper or a dolphin. Even those that are trained to bounce balls and do a variety of tricks in the name of entertainment are unlikely to give their consent or understand all the ins and outs of such a complex legal arrangement. The inevitable danger will be if animals are, instead of payment, promised funding for veterinary care or annihilation of slave and forced labour. As my second wife always said, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it shave.
That's part two of the Penguin Trilogy of Colin Hansard's Age of the Microwave Dinner. Do you get a bit annoyed at people who are fighting the causes of certain kinds? That's what that kind of comes off a little bit off that poem to me, Colin.
Yeah, it's one of those things we have to deal with, but that's certainly one of the questions that we hate being asked, because it's a hard question to answer. There's so many topics that we write about. Mm. As you mentioned, there's life and relationships and death and all those other things that poets are obsessed with.
And penguins, clearly, in your case as well. I might finish up by playing some of Potions and Elixirs. You might explain where this comes in the book, first of all, Colin, and why I can actually listen to this as opposed to get you to do it, to read it for me down the line.
Sure. So this is actually a poem from section two of Age of the Microwave Dinner. And this is the section where I discuss kind of my family and relationships and growing up. And I had attended a poetry writing workshop with the great Manchester poet Tony Walsh. And we'd been exploring the theme of home and using kind of the sensory experience around that. And so I wrote down some ideas in Tony's workshop. And after the workshop, or the weeks after the workshop, I was kind of researching Belfast history and building in my own memories. And I came out with this poem called Potions and Elixirs. And I'm a big fan of Van Morrison, especially the kind of the Astral Weeks era. And I had this idea in my head that maybe I could put some of my poems to music. And I contacted a good friend of mine, Ashley Manners, who's a guitar player and a musical arranger who I've been working with for many years. And we just started kind of building it up, and we got our friends and our family involved. My brother-in-law, Colin Carrigan, plays cajon. We got our friend Seanad Murray, who plays saxophone, our friend Matt Rizzo, who's on piano. And it really kind of adds another level to the poem.
There's also a video that goes along with this, which gives us some great shots of Belfast as well, and real nostalgic feel to it. No doubt echoes of Van Morrison in here, not least in the saxophone playing, but in the words as well. Colin, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Thanks for being with us. That's
thank you.
Colin Hassard speaking to us about his collection, Age of the Microwave Dinner. And let's listen to some of Potions and Elixirs.
I was planted in earth that rests in shadow of either harp or crown. In the mouth of the sandbanks as the hourglass was turned. In a room with dentist stickers half peeled on white plastic cupboards. And a pylon portrait framed in chamois sparkled window. A seed sown in bar and lanyon crafted brick and stone. Where factory men in flat caps are photographs of our foundations. The tobacco scent lingers.
Yeah, definitely a touch of Van Morrison about that saxophone playing and the words there of Colin Hassard. And that's his poem, Potions and Elixirs, which is part of his debut collection, The Age of the Microwave Dinner. And Colin is at the Eastside Arts Festival in Belfast on Sunday, the 8th of August. You can find out full details on eastsidearts.net. And The Age of the Microwave Dinner is published by Thura Press. Irish author Martina Murphy published her latest novel earlier this month, a crime thriller entitled The Night Caller. The book tells of a body found on Dugarth East Bog on Achill Island, which turns out to be that of a popular local teacher called Lisa Morn, sending shockwaves through the local community. When Achill Island native D.S. Lucy Golden is assigned to investigate, she takes a personal interest in the case. Martina Murphy joined us recently to read from the opening of the novel, and this passage is narrated by the perpetrator, also known as the Captain, who talks about a murder he committed 8 months previously.
But Jesus, she'd been some feckin' weight, the size of her, and she'd been a screamer to boot. And he had struggled, feckin' struggled, to carry her from the bathroom, where she made a right mess, across the bog to the water tank. But it was done now. Save for the owl fella in the house mithering and moaning. He should finish him off too while he was at it. He wiped his hands down the legs of his jeans, bits of blood and spatter making a right mess of them. He'd have to do a great tidy up on the place, so he would. Bleach the place. Pearl, her name had been. But she was no pearl amongst women, that was for certain sure. An owl bitch. Just like the other one years ago. He'd given Pearl a chance, but her trying to work the old man against him was something he wasn't prepared to overlook. And the old man, falling for it all over again. That had cut deep, so it had. Pearl had died roaring. All in all, it was a sad state of affairs. And now, after all the shouting and screaming, was just silence. He put his hands into his pockets, took a final look at the water tank, a final look at the fields. It had not been meant to go like this. The next one would be better.
Martina Murphy there, reading from her latest novel, The Night Caller, which is out now and published by Constable. Erykah Badu burst onto the worldwide music scene in 1997 with her multi-platinum debut album, Badu is, with soulful and jazz-tingled voice, often compared to that of Billie Holiday. She drew influences from the hip-hop movement of the 1980s alongside 1970s soul and funk. Erykah Badu has not been the most prolific of artists, it would have to be said, since that breakthrough, having released just 5 albums over the 24-year period since her debut. But she has maintained a level of critical acclaim through those 2.5 decades, and 5 releases, and remains a hugely respected artist even now, 10 years after her last full studio album. So here on this Tuesday evening to answer our oft-asked question, where do I begin with? In this case, Erykah Badu, is fellow singer and fan Jess Cavanagh. Let's start with how many people describe her music, if we could, Jess. Erykah Badu, that is. She's hailed as a queen of neo-soul, and it was Baduism from 1997 that really, that album that gave her that title. Do you think that's a good description of what she gives us in sound terms?
There is absolutely an element of that. Really, the term neo-soul came from her manager at the time, once she was signed to Universal. He was also looking after D'Angelo as well. D'Angelo was doing amazing. And I think they were looking for a way to kind of tie in the narrative of what the next movement or the next step or the next evolution was of soul, of funk and so on. And to be able to sell that to people in the 90s and in the 2000s. And they came up with neo soul. And like, I mean, it absolutely is a term. It's a term that I use for my music as well, for sure. It has those elements of, you know, something that's a lot more electronic. You know, it's taking in elements of hip hop. It's taking in elements of jazz. It's taking in elements of funk. But it's slightly more of a hip hop influence predominantly than maybe some of the older stuff, like, for example, like Chaka Khan and stuff that was coming out of the 80s, Bootsy Collins, Parliament Funkadelic, But Erykah Badu was always this person who kind of surpassed genres, you know, never wanted to see herself in a particular pigeonhole, but was happy to have kind of that stamp upon her, I guess. But she always considered herself a child of funk, and when she speaks about it, that's really what she says about her.
Yeah, because I wondered, and particularly in the first track that you, the one that you're suggesting we start out with, which brings us back to Baduism, that debut album, in Apple Tree, the hip hop is pretty much to the fore here. Often we associate hip hop maybe with, you know, kind of issue driven music as much as anything else. Is that here?
To an extent, you know, Apple Tree is very much a song that I always think of as a self-actualization song. You know, she's, and in a way, actually, yeah, that is very much traditional in hip hop. You know, if you had like, you know, if you had your posse, if you had your crew and you were introducing yourself, that's what you would do. You would introduce yourself and then you would say what you were about, what your philosophy is and why you were doing hip hop. So in a way, it does actually very much tie into early traditional 80s hip hop. And the thing about Badu is that she always actually wanted to be a writer. She wanted to be an MC. And this is the first song, which always blows my mind. This is the first song she wrote. Like, this is, and it's unbelievable. And like, she can still play it today, and it's so, so fresh. And it blows my mind. And it's called Apple Tree.
I can't control the soul flowing in me. Ooh-wee, ooh-wee. See, I picked my friends like a big fruit. Again, he told me that when I was only you. I don't walk around trying to be with a knife. Please me, cause I can't please you, and that's why I do what I do. My soul flies free like a willow tree.
Apple Tree from Erykah Badu, and that from her debut album Baduism. And it's Jess Cavanagh who's with us this evening answering and asking, where do I begin with Erykah Badu? It is extraordinary when you think that was from a debut album, practically, as you say, the first time she wrote, Jess. So where had she come from? To, you know, it's not surprising that it was such a big hit, Baduism, but where was she coming from before that huge splash into the music industry?
So she was coming, she grew up in Texas. And she came from School of the Arts. I don't have the name exactly of the School of the Arts, but she came from an art school. So she grew up and she was always, she talks about really being drawn to percussion, really being drawn to beats, not necessarily being drawn to music theory or to potentially kind of like melodic instruments or so on, but really loved comedy, loved writing, loved poetry and loved hip hop. And that's really where her kind of loves lie. It's one of the reasons why I love her as well, is because I think that she has that kind of holistic approach to music and sees herself predominantly as a creative. So she was very, I mean, as much as I say it was the first thing she wrote, it was her first song that she wrote maybe, but I mean, she'd already been, I think, a very established artist by the time she was beginning to write her own music.
And that that holistic approach to music, I suppose that's there as well in the title of the album, Badoism, obviously a play on Buddhism. Does she identify herself with any particular organized religion?
No, she's very particular, I think, in not aligning herself with any specific ideology. I think she's very pro-evolution. And I think as a result of that, she tries not to kind of ally herself. And I think it allows her for her genres to move, for her influences to move, and just to kind of go where she feels the most free, I think. And like, certainly for me, the kind of holistic approach is something that I was always drawn to. As a singer looking for that kind of inspiration for somebody who isn't necessarily about instruments, because, you know, I grew up in the jazz scene and everybody was so into like their technique and so into like, you know, being the best guitarist, being the best drummer, being the best horn player. And for me, I was like, I kind of want to play a little bit of everything. I kind of want a little bit of poetry. I want to do a little bit of writing. I want to do a little bit of spirituality. And she very much embodies that beautifully. And she understands that creativity as a whole is so important. So music is a part of that to her. And she talks about music being her therapy and also something that she also gets paid to do. And I really love that about her.
Window Seat is the second song that you've chosen for us. There's a lot of controversy, I suppose, in the case of Window Seat, simply around the video for Window Seat, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're going a bit of fast forward here because, you know, Apple Tree is her first song, the second song on Badoism, which is 1997, I think, when it was released. Then Window Seat, we're talking about 2008. And New America Part 1 and Part 2, these are the two albums in particular that are quite political, that are kind of laying a lot of foundation, I think, to a lot of the social change culture that we see now. And in particular, Window Seat, a lot of the time, or how I interpret it, is really about kind of energy protection and protecting your energy so you can use your energy in the right way. And the video is not extremely, but it's quite controversial. So it is her, and it is self-directed, and she is walking up the grassy knoll where Kennedy was shot. And as she's walking up, she is stripping. And so it's kind of vulnerability. And she's taking her clothes off, and there's just one camera that's just following her as she takes her clothes off. And, you know, there's people kind of looking and they don't really understand. And at the beginning, people are like picking up her jacket and running after her, and then they realize there's something else going on. And it's really, really interesting to see how other people react around it. And then right at the end, she's completely naked, and she has to run into a van before she gets arrested.
And she talks about this being a protest against groupthink.
Yeah, and I think maybe she was seeing some of that emerging element coming from social media. You know, there's one of the songs that's really important as well in New America is called Master Teacher. And Master Teacher, you know, there's a lot of people who would talk about Master Teacher being a song that influenced Childish Gambino, Redbone, because one of the main things is about stay woke and that idea of being woke, that idea of being awake and enlightened and being aware of what's going on around you and not just following what everybody else is saying and what everybody else is thinking. That would be very much in her mindset, for sure.
Well, let's have a listen to a little bit of Window Seat then, your second choice for us. And it's from the album, as you say, New America Part 1 from 2008. So can I get a window seat? Window Seat from Erykah Badu, the choice of Jess Kavanagh in our Where Do I Begin slot. And you're quite right, Jess, when you say that I skipped over quite a bit to get to Window Seat. But before we leave Window Seat, I do want to speak about, she has been quite controversial in other areas as well, particularly, I suppose I should put inverted commas around her support for Bill Cosby, or should I put inverted commas around that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think that there's no support in regards to Bill Cosby or Kelly, but who Erykah Badu is, well, I mean, from my perspective of absorbing so much of what she puts out, is that she's an extremely spiritual person. And through my research, when she saw so much of the backlash that was happening with R. Kelly and Bill Cosby, what she was trying to say is that she still had love for R. Kelly unconditionally, and kind of said something similar in regards to Bill Cosby. In particular, kind of the more prominent time was, I think, January 2019 in Chicago. She was actually on stage, and she kind of very publicly in the middle of her concert kind of said, you know, that she was praying for R. Kelly, and it was met with a huge amount of negative backlash in real time and boos and so on. And what she was trying to say, and I think these are conversations that you would have with somebody one-to-one, or, you know, kind of within a context of, you know, people who do terrible things, do they deserve unconditional love? And how do you present that? And I think she did it in just a bit of a clumsy way.
Yeah, I suppose it's back
now,
to that.
A lot of people.
It is back to that old statement of, you know, hate the sinner, love the sinner, rather hate the sin. There was a touch of that in what she was saying.
A little bit. I mean, it's not something I feel like if somebody has suffered sexual assault, and if somebody has suffered that and they haven't been able to really express that anger, you know, because some people who are victims of R. Kelly, you know, these were 15 years ago, you know, up until very recently, you know, they deserve a time to express their feelings. And I think at that time, it's a time to support the survivors rather than support, you know, the alleged abusers.
And but, for sure, yeah. that was part of the reason that people got annoyed with her about both those statements. But let us go back to the music and the bit of the music story that I skipped over, which is Questlove and the Soul Quarians, which will set us into Didn't You Know?
Oh, yeah. OK, so this is kind of the golden era for me, you know, and certainly growing up, these are the things I want from the Irish music scene. I wanted a group like the Soul Quarians, and it's a community of people that kind of came out of, you know, the neo soul movement, you know, which was Questlove and the incredible J Dilla. You have Common, you have and all these incredible and the Roots. And you have these amazing albums that come out, and you have the Roots Phrenology, you've got D'Angelo's Voodoo, you've got Bilal's Firstborn Second, and you also have Erykah Badu, Mama's Gun. And so it's such a really interesting time, and you have somebody like J Dilla, who is so industrious that he's like whipping out CDs of beats to everybody, you know, like kind of, you know, volumes of like in the hundreds. And people are just working and working and working and working and working. And it's all happening in Electric Ladyland, which is in NYC and in New York. And so, it's Jimi Hendrix's old place, yeah.
So give me a little lead into Didn't You Know? And we'll finish up by listening to that from Mama's Gun from 2000.
Absolutely. So, Didn't You Know? On Mama's Gun, which is probably my favourite album, recorded in Electric Ladyland. Have a look.
Didn't You Know? From Erykah Badu from her 2000 album Mama's Gun. And it was Jess Kavanagh who was in our Where Do I Begin slot on this Tuesday evening. That is our lot here on Arena. Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I'll talk to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.